Database DevOps with Rob Richardson.
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host for helping you and your teams move fast, deliver quality, and run your software with confidence in Azure, all while using all of the .NET ecosystem and everything that it has to offer. I'm doing a ton of online user group presentations, and if you run a .NET or Azure-related user group, I'd love to give a presentation for you. Just reach out and let me know. Our top sponsor of the show, Clear Measure, makes this podcast happen, and they're a software architecture company that empowers .NET teams to be self-sufficient and able to deliver world-class results. So if we can help, please get in touch, and also be sure to check out the new video show, Architect Tips. And today on the show, we have an amazing interview with somebody who does tons of DevOps work in the database space and beyond. And so let's get into the interview. Rob Richardson is a software craftsman building web properties in ASP.NET and Node, React, and Vue. He's a Microsoft MVP, a published author. He's a frequent speaker at conferences, user groups, community events, and a diligent teacher and student of high-quality software development. And you can find recent talks and musings on robrich.org/presentations. You can also follow him on Twitter at rob_rich. Rob, welcome back to the show. How are you, sir?
Doing well. It's so great to be here on the show. We got to do this last time in person, and We're doing this virtually. This is fun.
Yeah, it was almost 2 years ago at one of the old Microsoft Ignite conferences. With a lot of background noise. So show number 35 or 6, something like that. Listeners can go back and listen to that show.
And now we're up to like 200 or 300, right?
No, well, show number 131, I think that we're at right now.
That is pretty cool. Congratulations on the durability of this podcast. That's really awesome. Quite an accomplishment.
Oh, well, thanks. I think people have found it interesting. I think the unique nature is, we talk about Microsoft platform software, but the lens is always of how to assemble and operate that software well. What things do allow us to move quickly, what things do allow us to increase quality, and then running the software system so that they can stay stable in a production environment. There's all kinds of frameworks that come and go, and new tech and libraries and all that stuff, and that fits in there. But the kind of underlying theme is, how would that type of application run in production? What does it look like? Are there any interesting things around testing that type of framework, things like that?
Yeah. And that lens of durability is really powerful. If we can take a look at it and kind of understand the entire lifecycle, then we're not really building in our bubble and throwing it over the wall, but rather we're building a piece in context that can really shine and excel there.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Now, I think you just got finished with a training class a few weeks ago, didn't you?
Yeah.
And you're teaching a lot. And so you've got you do a ton of DevOps work and helping teams to get set up properly. What's your take on the state of DevOps today, and how do you think about that whole space?
That is such a brilliant and insightful question, and I love it. When I start looking at DevOps, I kind of take a step back and look at, what is DevOps about? When I build out a DevOps pipeline, I start with a user suggestion. And that user suggestion is what puts tasks on our task board. Maybe we're using Trello or Jira or whatever task tracking system we have, but that's where it starts. It starts with that user comment. That a developer will take that task down and they'll build some source code. They'll check it into a source control system, and then the build server kicks off. When we start talking about DevOps, oftentimes we start there at the build server does stuff, but I really like to focus in instead on the customer created a suggestion.
Mm-hmm.
The build server then does some stuff. It will run the build. It will run a whole bunch of tests. It'll probably deploy it to a non-production environment where developers or QA can start to poke at it. Maybe we push it to a pre-prod environment where stakeholders and investors can take a look at it. Maybe advanced customers can take a look at it. And then we'll, once it's good, we'll finally deploy it into production. And oftentimes that's where our DevOps pipeline stops as well. But really there's another step after that as well, which is customers gain value from this feature and can offer suggestions. And that makes it a loop. We start with customer suggestions and we end with customer value. Our DevOps pipelines are about delivering customer value for the features that they need. If we can craft a DevOps pipeline that starts and ends with customers, then we can deliver stuff of value to our users. If we just focus on uptime, yeah, that's interesting. Or number of green builds, that's interesting as well. Code coverage even, maybe that's less helpful. But really, the metric that we're after is delivering value to customers. Can we measure things like time from feature suggestion to deployment or usage metrics around features? You know, can we create that mechanism that really focuses on customers as we're delivering this value? At that point, now we have a DevOps pipeline that is really making impact for our business.
So what does that part after production look like? What is it comprised of?
We'll probably have a lot of telemetry in our application to gather usage metrics. We may interview users. We may have user experience studies. Maybe the tasks coming in might help us. You know, are we getting bugs or feature requests on this feature? Or is the feature not even getting used at all? Do we need to move it in the menu so that it's more obvious or more descriptively described to be able to get that usage? That telemetry, that understanding, I think is what starts to drive the acceptance there.
Okay. So, and from hearing that description, doesn't sound like there's any vendors pushing products aimed squarely at that space. It sounds like some techniques and some patterns to achieve that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, there is a component of logging and monitoring. So we might look at Azure App Insights or New Relic or tools like that that can start to monitor our things. But then there's the other layer of maybe we have Google Analytics or other marketing tools that will start to tell us about, you know, where on the page did they click? What was the next page they visited? Those types of tools. We can start to stitch them together into this framework to get an understanding of how our application is used and the user journey through our application. We can start talking about user funnels where a user will do this and then this, and you know, we're trying to guide them towards a checkout or a purchase. And that starts to tie into this as well. Uptime is a piece as well. If the system is offline, of course, it's not delivering value, but it's about understanding holistically the system given all of these tools and all of these insights together.
Well, awesome. Now, just to back up a little bit, so it's the people who might not go to your trainings or have heard you speak publicly, you've been doing this for a long time, and Microsoft's recognized you with an MVP award. But what's your journey been as a developer? You've been doing it for a while, and you kind of ebbed and flowed. What kind of development have you bobbed and weaved through?
This is a lot of fun. I started my journey into software development when I was 10. I was in the library because they had the computer. And the way the computer worked is you'd go to the desk and you'd flip through this binder. They had sheets explaining each game in sheet protectors, and you'd flip through and you'd pick a game. So I had finished playing this game. I went back up to the desk and I was flipping through the book, and I picked a new game, and it was a drawing program. And I'm like, hey, this could be pretty cool. They didn't hand me a disc. They handed me an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. Mm. The top 2/3 of it was a grid, and it said, draw a picture. And the bottom 1/3 was, here's how to write a program to draw that picture on the screen.
Sweet.
And that was so fun. To some degree, if we can find 10-year-olds and kind of give them that excitement, that euphoria in being able to build programs, that would be so much fun. So I found this passion of building software, and it was just really fun. As I was getting through college, I was like, okay, you know, this is fun. It's a cool hobby. I didn't realize that I could do this as a career. It wasn't until I graduated and I had realized that the majority of the projects that I had done were about building software to do the thing that I was trying to accomplish rather than accomplishing the thing, that I'm like, yeah, let me see if I can lean into this. I started with .NET when I was first looking at software development. I was comparing .NET and Java, and all the Java apps felt like they didn't really fit. You know, the UI wasn't seamless. They didn't look like Windows apps or Mac apps. They looked like Java apps.
Spring.
So I kind of tilted towards .NET. I was doing .NET web Windows forms at the time. I started working in web forms after that. And as I started down that journey into the .NET ecosystem, I didn't realize I had chosen a tribe at the time. I was kind of eager to learn all the things. And so, you know, I would intentionally draw the short straw. Well, we need to deploy this. Can somebody figure out how to power IIS? Okay, yeah, I'll go figure out IIS. So I figured out how to set up a web server, a little bit about Windows administration. In time, that turned into, well, can we do this in an automated way? So I started wandering around and I found cruise control at cruisecontrol.net. And so I set up a .NET build server that would be able to build and deploy into IIS. And from there, it's like, well, can we do testing? And so I figured out how to do unit tests and mocks and dependency injection and MVC patterns and MVP patterns and MVVM patterns. And so with each of these steps, I started to take on a new skill and a new responsibility, a new learning in how to get this process smooth from software development, from developers coding, all the way to delivering value to users on a production system. And so now I can do a bunch of DevOps. I do GitHub Actions really well. I've done Azure DevOps. I've done coding in ASP.NET and in Node. The Node journey was actually really fun. I started in trying to learn JavaScript because I figured that I would get better at web programming by kind of getting a feel for JavaScript. Mm-hmm. And as I got deeper into the Node community, I realized that my C# was getting better too, because, well, Node has a very asynchronous mechanism, callbacks. We've now moved to promises and async and await, but callbacks in JavaScript are lambdas in C#. And so I started seeing lambdas appearing a whole lot more in the code I was writing. And I'm like, hey, that's really cool. By cross-pollinating these tribes, I can get some really cool patterns. As we got to more thick clients in the browsers, single-page applications, then I dug into AngularJS and Backbone before that. And now my chosen framework is typically Vue, but I also do quite a bit of React and Angular when it's necessary. And so it's fun to be able to dig into each of these tribes and start to learn it. I'm starting to see if I can play with Python a little bit. And Python is weird because I'm used to the curly braces. I haven't done non-curly brace things since I did Visual Basic in VBA. But Python is the language of data science. And so it's fun to start to step into that tribe as well.
That's a lot. Yeah, that's a lot of different things. One of the interesting things, no matter how the front-end frameworks change or new things that come out, it seems like we still always have that database that we're reading and writing from. And in the DevOps world, there's a lot of examples in how to do things for a website, but that's got to be the simplest process type. And maybe that's why there's so many samples on it. But what do we need to think about with the database? You do a lot of work with SQL Server and other types of databases in DevOps environments, right?
Yeah, definitely. And database is kind of that last mile of doing interesting things. In all the other environments, you know, you mentioned websites, but if we look at mobile apps or even desktop apps, the final deployment is to remove whatever was there and pave over it with whatever we want to put in place. Whether that's a phone app or it's an Alexa skill or it's a watch or TV app, all of those have that same characteristic. It turns out with databases, if you blow away what's there and create a new one,
that's a problem.
Customers kind of get a little grumpy. Right. You know, the data is really the master, the critical piece there. The fact that we have schema around it and other monitoring and uptime tools to keep it healthy is kind of interesting, but the critical piece is the data. And so when you're doing DevOps with a database, you can't just blow it away and start over. Rather, you have to migrate it from where it was to where it needs to be. And so that mechanism of migrating the schema, also migrating the data as you do DevOps, is really cool. Now, there's two major methodologies here. There's a state-based approach and a migrations-based approach. In a state-based approach, I will dump all of the schema that I have for my database, usually as create scripts. So I'll create a new table, I'll create a new view, I'll create a stored procedure, and I'll version those scripts. As the schema evolves, I will dump over the top of that. Now, the beauty here is you can take a look at those scripts and you can do a git blame. It's unfortunate it's called that, but it's really elegantly named. You can see the history. You can see columns appear and disappear. You can see tables and stored procedures evolve over time. Where did this line come from? Why is it there? The state-based approach is really good at answering that question. The downside is when I have a state-based approach and I want to then take that schema and apply it to a new database, I have to have an engine that's really smart to be able to look at the files, look at the data, the database, and to build a pipeline to get from here to there, build a path. And the cool part is it will take the shortest path. The downside is it's going to make some assumptions. And so that state-based approach, I need that really smart engine to dig into it. By comparison, a migrations-based approach, I will craft scripts that will get it from where it was to where it will be in small increments as I'm building my features. So I'll start out by creating the table, and then I'll add a column. And each of these is a separate script. If I delete a column, or I split a table, or I change a data type, each of those will be a small migration script. When it comes time to deploy, then, I just run all of the scripts that haven't run yet. So I'll probably have a table in my database, a migration table, that will list all of the scripts that I've run. I'll probably have a table of migration scripts that will keep track of all of the scripts that I've run. And when it comes time to run the new scripts, I'll just look through my directory, I'll find all the scripts that haven't run, and I'll run them. And that's really cool because I've now paved that path really well. Each time I'm running my DevOps pipeline, I'm in effect testing my production deployment. I'm running the exact scripts that need to be run every time. So if it takes me 3 or 5 or 8 or 12 builds or maybe 2 weeks to be able to get this feature to a certain level of quality and durability, then I've practiced my deployment maybe a dozen or 100 times. When it comes time to deploy into production, it's probably going to go really, really well. On the downside, when I'm looking at these scripts, it's hard to know when this table came to be and what decisions led to it being that way. I have to open up each migration script. Is this the one that changed that field? Nope. Next script. Is this the one? And so when we're looking at the hybrid, at a migration-based approach versus a state-based approach, we may choose a hybrid approach. Stored procedures and views and user-defined functions and table-valued parameters, roles, all these things, pretty much everything that isn't a table, we can just drop and recreate. So a state-based approach for these makes a lot of sense. The migrations-based approach may make sense for tables, or maybe we're going to store both. We'll store both the current state and the scripts that gets us from here to there. At that point, then we have a level of confidence where we can say, I've run all the scripts before, and we can go look at the history and figure out when things happen. As we're kind of getting to that hybrid approach, now we can start to run really powerful migrations that will get us from here to there. Now, the assumption in this entire approach, though, is that the only thing modifying production is these migrations. It's possible that we end up in a scenario where some emergency happened, we needed to tune this one index, or we needed to adjust this column, and our migration scripts don't know that. In a state-based approach, we'll undo it in the process of deploying, which may or may not be helpful. In a migrations-based approach, maybe we'll just fail because it's a condition that we didn't expect. Mm-hmm. So part of making that process work is to take production backups and frequently move them out of production into non-production environments so that as our build system kicks up, it can start with what's in production and migrate it to what it needs to be. Now we have that level of confidence. If we're running all of these migration scripts on last night's production backup, we know that probably it'll work as we deploy this afternoon.
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery.
Now, you mentioned for migrations, keeping that history table and running all the scripts in a directory. Do you find yourself just building that process yourself, or do you find yourself selecting some tools to do that?
I've done both. I really like the when you set out to build a piece of software, you can craft it to be exactly what you need it to be. And I found fun in that. So I did build a system that can do this once. The beauty there was that I was writing both up and down scripts to apply the change and scripts to remove the change. And so what I could do is I could say, as I'm loading this script, I'm going to run the up script and I'm going to save the down script into the table. The beauty here then is I could look through the folder and look through the table and say, is there anything in the table that is no longer in the folder? Mm-hmm. That migration has been removed. Let's run the down script. And so that was really fun to build. I had a blast building that. At the same time, this is kind of a solved problem. There are lots of tools that are able to do this. I keep reaching for Redgate tools just because they are elegantly simple. That's our tagline, right? And I love it. And so there's a lot of places where I can just reach into their tools and do some elegant things. For the state-based approach, SQL Source Control is ideal. For the migrations-based approach, ReadyRoll is now called SQL Change Automation, and that is a really elegant tool to do this. Both of them have hybrid features, and so at the end of the day, when you're getting ready to deploy, they either pull in that really smart engine that can diff the things, or they pull in the scripts that you've created and just run them. They keep track of the scripts that you've run in a migrations table, and that's a really elegant tool. Entity Framework has tools to do this as well. And sometimes those are sufficient. What I find with Entity Framework tools in comparison to the Redgate tools and tools like this, Entity Framework wants to abstract it into C#. And a lot of what Entity Framework does that is really elegant is remove the SQL bits from us. Now that can be really helpful. Now we get type validation and we get compile time help and IntelliSense, and that's wonderful in our application. But because they've removed the SQL nature of it, if we're doing migrations like changing the data type or the length of a column, maybe that is a SQL operation. Now, Entity Framework can jump back into SQL, but that's why I kind of lean towards Redgate tools, because they focus in on the SQL. They let me solve the problem in the technology that I'm looking to solve it with. And so I really like solving these inside SQL rather than kind of abstracting them away.
Yeah, that's a good point. And there's always a little bit of data manipulation, like increasing. If you add a column to a table, the database is going to automatically set it to something. If it's a nullable column, okay, null. If it's not a nullable column, you got to give it a default value and it populates it with that. But What about splitting a table or taking a phone number field and splitting it into the area code and the rest of it? Now you have to also have some type of, you know, miniature ETL or miniature data movement kind of in between those steps. And yeah, it's really hard for any kind of engine to figure out what to do with existing data. Whereas right. at the time that you're deciding to do that change, you know exactly what to do with that data.
And your analogy of adding a column, there's a couple of things that go into that. Yeah, we could just set it to a default value or leave it null, but there's probably a business rule in our application that assumes content in that data. So what we'll typically do is we'll do three steps. We'll first add the column as nullable. Second, we will set the data in the column to something that makes sense. And it may take us a couple of statements to do this. Is null an acceptable value? Is zero an acceptable value? Blank? Or do we want to look to other columns to infer the data here? We'll populate the column with values. And then third, we will set it to not nullable. And so at that point, if we do all three of those in a transaction, now we've got all of our data and schema the way we expect. And the application now can treat it as if it always existed that way. We can do those three steps inside one transaction in a migration to be able to migrate it from it didn't exist to it exists and follows the business rules that we want on top of it. Mm-hmm. Then we can do maybe other migrations on top to migrate the schema in other ways. Or maybe we can infer the rest of the content into place. Let's just blast all of our store procedures over the top. But if we can do those three pieces inside of a transaction, then we know that we've got it to the place where we need it. As we start looking at other things, more advanced things like splitting columns or splitting tables, we'll probably take those exact three same steps. First, we'll put the new schema in place, nullable. Second, we'll move the data into place. And then third, we'll mark those as non-nullable or maybe trim obsolete schema. Now, we do need to be careful if we're in a place where the database DevOps pipeline runs separately from the application DevOps pipeline. The application may not know that this new content exists. And so the database does need to be able to handle this more gracefully. What we may have is one migration script that puts this new schema in place, and then a second migration script that may run, I don't know, a week, a month later, after the application has had a chance to deploy, that can clean up the old schema. Alternatively, we can choose that we're going to move forward only. We're going to only add content. That leads to some stale data, but that kind of removes that need for, did you run it yet? Is it time to run it yet? Did we forget?
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And there's some really cool Azure features and otherwise, where you can have multiple versions of the application running against the same database. Like, just even slot swapping in app service is just a tremendously useful feature. But if we've upgraded our database, now we need to know that the current and the plus one version both work well with that version.
Right. An elegantly simple solution to this problem is feature flags. And if you've never used feature flags before, I'm about to blow your mind. It is just magic. We can have a setting, let's put it in our database, that turns a particular feature in our application on or off. And so as we go try to run this feature, we're going to go check the database. And yeah, maybe we'll cache it. And if it's on, then we'll run this code. And if not, we won't. Facebook started doing chats by putting hidden iframe in browsers so that it would get network traffic to be able to understand the load of Facebook Messenger. And then they flipped the feature flag, and now Facebook Messenger was visible. We've separated deployment and publish, or deployment and release. And that's really weird because when we typically do it, we typically talk about both things together. The business people want this feature live on the website.
Yeah.
Does that really embody cutting code and pushing code to servers? Well, it could, but with feature flags, those can be separate. Let's deploy it and turn it off. And then when we're ready, let's turn it on. Well, the beauty there, if we put our feature flags in the database, we can deploy the content and turn on the feature flag in the same schema migration. So maybe the app was deployed first to use the new schema, but that feature is disabled. And then when we deploy our database schema that supports it, now we can turn on this feature flag. Or maybe that feature flag is governed by business and business can turn it on when they're ready. We don't need to hold this feature from getting deployed just because they're not ready to release it yet.
Now, do you like to build that pattern yourself, or are there any products that have risen above the rest?
What's really cool is, as a pattern, that methodology of just turning on and off code based on a table in a database is super easy. Mm-hmm. You know, we can have a table. One column is the key name. Maybe it's a string or maybe it's a number that links to an enumeration in our app, either way. And then the other column is a Boolean flag. That table is super simple to build. With a pattern like that, we can turn it on and off globally. But then there's methodologies of like, well, can we turn it on for this user? Can we turn it on for this deployment? Can we turn it on if the software version gets to be this thing? Can we turn it on when we enroll this account in an advanced feature? And that's where building it yourself starts to get a little bit more complex. LaunchDarkly is a really elegant system that does feature flags as a service. And so now I can pass in my user token, whatever that is. So, you know, I'm not exposing PII, and the feature name, and they'll hand me back a flag of, you know, on or off. And I can cache the answer to prevent network failures. Their SDK also does really elegant things where it'll return the default if I have a network failure. But the beauty there is I can get a whole lot more complex scenarios. So I can create canary releases or beta channels or user-specific settings. And then I just log into the LaunchDarkly dashboard and I can turn things on and off in a really elegant way. So if you need that kind of advanced functionality, then products like LaunchDarkly can do a really great job there. If you just need a simple thing that'll turn it on and off just to break that deployment and release coupling, then just a simple table can get you past stuck. When you find that you need those advanced features, then start to export your table into a service and start to leverage their advanced features.
Sweet, sweet. Well, hey, that's a lot of great information. Awesome deep dive into database DevOps and even taking DevOps past just the production release and make sure that we complete that loop. So this is awesome. This is awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks, Rob, for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Yeah, definitely. What's really fun about database DevOps is typically when we look at it, we look at the app perspective, where the app is the master copy and we can start with source control and just blow it all the way into production. When I start looking at database DevOps, what's really fun is it often works the other way. My master copy is in production and I need to move that data into non-production environments in a very automated way. Mm-hmm. And that's what gets really fun.
Yeah, nice. Now, as we close, where should people go if they might be interested in your training?
Definitely. I do a lot of conference speaking and I'll always post my content on robrich.org. So you can go to robrich.org, click on presentations and get the code and slides for all the presentations I've done. I also tweet quite a bit. My Twitter is @rob_rich and you can find a whole lot there too. And if you want to, click on contact me from there, email me and let's dig into lots of stuff. If you'd like to do trainings or customized things, apprenticing, mentorship, then you know, hit me up and let's see what we can do. It's a lot of fun getting to share and teach and learn together. And so I would love to engage with you to do really fun stuff.
Awesome. Hey, well, thanks again, Rob, for coming on the show. This is a great conversation.
Yeah, definitely. It's been so much fun being here. Thanks for having me on.
Awesome. And until next time, keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps Podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.